vanity project. C'est la vie. Vanity project. Quiet please. It's a vanity project with James and Bridie.
Hello, it's me, Bridie, one of the hosts of Vanity Project, which is a podcast you're listening to right now. The other host, who you can hear giggling away, is James Colley. What do you think? Did I nail that introduction?
We just said, I think Bridie should do the intro because you're really good at introductions. And the first thing you open with is, hello, it's me, Bridie.
I panicked. Okay, hang on. Take two. Hello and welcome to Vanity Project, the podcast where we listen to the questionable albums of a whole bunch of Hollywood superstars. That was way better.
Hey.
That was way better.
I'm going to use both takes. today's album is John Travolta's Travolta Fever, which I am so excited to get into. I've caught Travolta Fever, Bridie.
So have I. And no matter the treatment, it just keeps coming back.
Mm-hmm. I've got chills. They're multiplying.
Oh, man. I've felt Travolta Fever for a long, long time. As I have mentioned before, I was in a very successful sold-out run of Grease as a 17-year-old. So I've been a John Travolta fan for a long, long time. I would also like to do a special shout-out to my friend Dickie, who after Beck Shaw and James Colley roundly mocked the casting of Yours Truly as Rizzo in that production of Grease, reached out to me to say, they're wrong. You nailed Rizzo. So thank you, Dickie.
We didn't say you wouldn't nail Rizzo. We said you are a Sandy.
But I am an actor. I want to be challenged. Anyway, as much as we could spend the whole podcast talking about the beautiful theatrical heights of that production of Grease, that is not the Travolta Fever we're talking about today.
Yes, this is his album from 1978. So it is a real peak Travolta. I've got to say, John Travolta has one of the more fun Wikipedia articles because it's a roller coaster ride. It's like 70s stardom, 80s downturn, 90s resurgence, downturn, 2000s. What the fuck is he doing right now?
It's a real roller coaster.
And speaking of, how's this for a personal life? Family, Scientology, flying, other, sexual assault allegation.
Ooh.
Which, good that that's away from other. You don't want to just stick that in other.
It deserves its own category. I mean, you've just mentioned a few of the key things already that I think of when I think of John Travolta, flying being one of them. He's been a Qantas ambassador since the early 2000s, which is such a strange celebrity endorsement deal, but I'm all about it.
Do you know, we just grew up with this. This was just a cultural product of Australia that we inherited. And I've never stopped to interrogate, why did we give John Travolta a plane? We're just like, oh, do you know what? Do you want to fly the plane? You seem like a very popular actor. Maybe you should fly our largest commercial jets.
Nobody batted an eyelid. They're like, that makes sense. To be fair, at the end of Grease Lightning, he does make the car fly. So if he can do that, if he can do that to an automobile, like surely he's an aviation genius. In doing some research for this, he has his own private fleet of aircraft, including multiple Gulfstream aircraft, an Eclipse 500, which is a light jet, apparently, and, of course, the Qantas Boeing 707. So there you go. Yeah.
John Travolta has his own private military that, if he does not like this episode, he could come and get us.
Should we be worried? Okay, so aviation, Greased Lightning. What else do you think about when you think of John Travolta?
Well, more than most of our actors that we have on this, music. Like, he does seem, he's always been a good singer, let's say. Like, that he had a good voice. Then, and it's important to say, like, we're in 70s Travolta now. We are not him turning up in that dramatized OJ story where he looks like the Madame Tussauds version of himself. Like, I should ask here, what is your favorite Travolta?
My favorite Travolta. See, isn't it funny because I obviously love Grease, but I love Saturday Night Fever Travolta. But when I look back on that Travolta, it's a much happier, light, you know, disco, dancey, fun, bright role. And then I actually rewatched the movie a little while ago and I was like, this is a really gritty, dark film. But my image of Travolta from that period is the antithesis of that. But I am a fan of that. I also like Pulp Fiction Travolta.
Yeah, in my head, he's always 90s Travolta. I'm thinking Pulp Fiction. I'm thinking Face Off, one of the greatest. Like, there was only one decade that you could really get away with to get into this criminal's web. We are going to rip off his face and put it on your body. And we're going to cast two men with exactly the same body type, Nicolas Cage and John Travolta.
Okay, so given what you've just said there, though, James, that more than any other star we've looked at on this podcast so far, John Travolta does have a musical background. When I got your message the other week and you'd pitched this album as one for us to cover, it made total sense to me that John Travolta had released an album. And I wanted to know, I think, like, what makes it a Vanity Project? In, like, not just for John Travolta, for any star, because when I saw this, I was like, oh, yeah, he's a triple threat. He's well known for dancing. He's been in a big musical at this time. The soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever at this time was, I think, the biggest selling soundtrack in the world. So there's a lot of musical connotation with him. So is it a vanity project, therefore?
Oh, well, now we're getting existential on the very nature of the podcast.
Sorry, now, I'm a philosopher.
I think it's an interesting question. Like, what I would say is he's both, like, this album particularly, we do have Saturday Night Fever in Greece, but he's also a massive star from Welcome Back, Kotter. And this feels like more in the Welcome Back, Kotter world of it's Travolta's stardom is exploding and we're letting him do everything. It's like, this is to the 70s what the Bartman was to the early 90s. Like, you don't need it. It's just you're so famous, you should also have this album. And I also say, like, similarly, if anyone in La La Land released their own album right after La La Land, despite it being a very popular musical that came in the top two of the Oscars that year, like, we would say that's a vanity project. And I think that this is because if he was just on Grease or just on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, they would not be vanity projects, and we're not talking about that. But this is an album that builds off the fame of that and Travolta and calls itself Travolta Fever, which is an incredibly confident name and one that you have to be sure. Like, you can imagine what happens in 2019 if Delta Goodrum releases Delta Fever and then this happened. Like, you have to be certain there is no Travolta Fever actually coming around in the next couple of years.
You've made an exceptionally good point there, and I think that's really important for all artists looking to release albums there, that they take heed of that very good advice. Okay, I think you're on the money there. I think that's right. It's all about the context of his career at this point and leveraging or capitalizing on the fame. It's hard to overstate what a star, a megastar John Travolta was at this moment in time as well. Like, of course, as we've just said, we've got images of him from the 70s and the 90s. He goes away for a while, then he pops up in a bunch more movies. But at this moment in time in 1978, his star is really huge and bright. He's known worldwide. And this quote from Rolling Stone, from an article from 1978, his force is physical, not quite excessively sexual. He burns a hotter temperature than humans normally do. And I'm like, whoa, okay. He's a heartthrob. He's beloved. It is still the height of disco fever. So he's just like a massive, massive star. And I think because he has been a bit of a punchline at points, it's easy to forget that. He really was a megastar. Yeah.
I think that before you ever take the advice of your parents, you should remember that for a while, this was the coolest guy they could imagine. Brady, can we talk about in this light the album cover of Travolta Fever,
which
I would describe as John Travolta mid-dance sucked into a Windows 95 screensaver. It's like he's lost in a void of flashing lights behind him and is clearly, you know, that, like, I thought this was a joke cover someone had put together.
Same.
For it, because It's exactly that level of, I don't quite know how to Photoshop that, say, all of the graphics for this podcast have, because I've put them together. it could use a drop shadow. It could use just something. It does not. It looks so tacky and bad.
I would also really like to encourage our listeners, given that this is obviously an oral medium, please, please go and look at this album cover, because I really just want you to put it in your eyes. The hair is the biggest hair I've seen in a long, long time. And also the title itself, Travolta Fever, just screams word art to me.
Yeah.
It's just, it looks more like an instructional aerobics workout video to me than an album. Is that fair to say?
I think you're right. And it's important to note, like, this isn't an image that a modern artist is putting out that appears in an icon when you're playing it on Spotify. This was a 2-record vinyl set. Like, this is coming out with large vinyl art. You really have, like, you think of the great record covers of your life. You really can make a statement with this. And the statement he made is, not trying that hard.
Yikes. None of the colors go together. The whole thing is just a little sickly looking.
It's a real, like, it's 3:30 p.m. on a Friday and we realize that no one has made the cover art. And you're like, oh, shit, okay, I'm not staying back, but I'll put something together for you.
Well, with that said, hopefully we've painted a good picture. And we're going to see if the tracks match up to the album cover itself. So Travolta Fever is a 1978 compilation album. It was released on the Midsong International label. When James sent this to me, dear, dear listeners, the first thing I did, I opened up the album and I went, wow, what a long album. There's many, many songs in it. I listened to them all. I made my little notes, which I'm excited to share with you. And it was only after I'd listened to the entire album that I'd realized, not for the first time in the history of our friendship, that James is an idiot. And in fact, Travolta Fever is a compilation of 2 previous albums that John Travolta has released. So in 1976, he released John Travolta, which peaked at 39 in the US charts. And the year after, he released another album called Can't Let You Go. And then this is 1978, where he goes, you know what? Let's take the best bits from both albums and re-release it. So you've made me review 2 albums here, James.
this is shocking to me as someone who didn't do this research and is learning this as we speak.
I know you are. I didn't tell you before we started recording.
Because I check this as my level of research, which is clicking on the discography button of Spotify and scrolling as far down as I could. this is a best of. Now, we are not going through every track on this. Mm-mm. In fact, I reckon we're probably just going to quit out pretty early on it, but it is worth knowing. That's remarkable to me that this is the pick of the litter, because we're now going to come back and find the worst of John Travolta. This will be our reprisal of this.
It's interesting to me, too, as a career move to do a best of album only after 2 years. You know, normally bands go, oh, remember that great song we released 15 years ago plus that one from 3 years ago? But this is like, no, the one from last week and the week before that, put it on the best of. That's what's happening here.
Well, let's get into it and have a listen with the first single that I believe went to number 2 in the UK charts.
Wow.
Let Her In.
Gonna let her in my life. Let her in my life.
That was Let Her In by John Travolta from Travolta Fever, a song that some people mistakenly believe went to number 2 on the UK charts, but in fact did not at all. It did peak at number 10 in the US Billboard charts, however.
Yes, well done. We love that you've swiftly corrected yourself there. I was about to jump in, but you've done it. You've done it for me, which I love. Okay, one of the funniest things about this album to me is that the opening track is called Let Her In, and the second track is called Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. Like, the titles alone are painting quite the story here. Poor old John Travolta is nursing a broken heart. It's interesting, isn't it? Because when I think of John Travolta from this disco era, have you seen the movie Saturday Night Fever?
I have not.
It's, you know, fairly gritty in parts. It's, you know, it's such a product of its time. But the vision of John Travolta that I have doesn't really match this very sweet voice. It sounds like it's quite an innocent arrangement. It's an innocent vocal performance. It's kind of, well, it's more Sandy than Danny.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like because I was expecting coming in, particularly coming in on a big number, I thought we were in for a Bee Gees song. Like that's kind of the area I was expecting. High paced disco dancing. I'm the coolest thing around and here's my song. This is soft and gentle. It is very early 70s. And I kind of like it, actually. When I was listening to this, I actually got to the end of this song and I thought, oh, this is actually quite good. Are we going to have enough to talk about on this episode?
Oh, well, let me tell you, listeners, we will. But yeah, I think it's a nice, sweet start. It's like that lovely boy from down the road has done his beautiful performance at the end of year school recital. You know, that's the vibe. It's innocent, it's lovely, it's accessible.
It's Aldi, the long and winding road.
100%. Now, let's go from the heady heights of Letter In, the optimistic, sweet, gentle song, to Never Gonna Fall in Love Again.
We shouldn't have let her in.
Never gonna fall in love again.
That was Never Fall in Love Again, John Travolta, Travolta Fever. Bridie, what were your first thoughts on this?
My first thoughts are, given his musical theatre background, and in fact I looked into, you know, his family, there was a lot of actors and musical theatre folk in his family too. It feels like the end of Act One or like of a musical. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of got that sort of triumphant, hopeful, we're going to pull ourselves out of this and everything's going to be okay, boys, type feeling to it. It doesn't feel like it belongs on a disco album at all.
No, absolutely. Like you are a huge musical fan. I am absolutely not. And when the piano kicked in at the very top of this song, I thought, here comes some bullshit. It really felt like I was expecting someone to be fucking coming out of the wings, holding a little umbrella, dancing back and forth, doing a little twirl. Everyone in the background is like looking over all at once and wiping their eyes and all that shit that happens in musicals. But that said, I like this song. I thought this was quite a good song. I thought I liked the hook of it. I like two songs in, I'm like, this is too good an album. We can't get an episode out of this. He's very good at music.
You know what's funny too, that this is a song that screams screams musical theater to us, and it is not the song called Razzmatazz, which is track 5. We will get to it. That's not the musical theater song, everybody. Now the next song on the album is 2:22, but it is also the longest song ever recorded. It's called Rainbows.
All over the world you'll find it's the same. You can have rainbows without the rain, without the rain.
That was Rainbows, John Travolta, Travolta Fever. So this sonically sounds quite a lot like Golden Brown, only it's the after effects of taking a lot of heroin that you are stuck in this loop for 14 hours. And I thought the Rainbows Without Any Rain thing was always attributed to Dolly Parton. Is it not a Dolly Parton line? I was outraged listening to this.
It's not a Dolly Parton thing. It's a weather thing.
I thought she invented the weather, Bridie.
I mean, she has done a lot for the world, so I wouldn't put it past her. To me, this song, Rainbows, it's not just hold music. It's like hold music in purgatory.
Yeah, it's your elevator has broken down and it was taking you to be euthanized anyway.
Okay, so what I find interesting about this album so far is when you look at the cover and you look at the context in which this album is released, you go, I know exactly what I'm in for, which is a hilarious, fun, dancey disco time, right? Disco fever. It's well and truly out there. It's Travolta fever. So far, we haven't really got that at all. It's been a very gentle start to this album. We've been promised disco and we haven't got it yet. But the next track, A Girl Like You, is where I finally get that Travolta fever.
You, oh yeah, you, nobody but you.
This is what I wanted. That was A Girl Like You. This is what I wanted. This is what I thought the album is. This is what I want. You've got that classic kind of disco slap bass. The hi-hats are going crazy. You've got a horn section. You've got a bit of drama. We've got tempo. We've got what feels like a really great B-movie opening credits song. This is what I thought the album was.
It is absolutely, like, this is the theme song for a detective show, like a Miami Vice knockoff, where the whole time that this happy music is playing, you're watching them falsely arrest someone and kick the shit out of them on a curbside.
100%. And is it so wrong that that's what we want, James?
And you're right, though. Like, this is the first song that's fun. All the rest, like, he lets her in, she fucks up his life, and he deals with that for two whole songs, and now he's ready to love again.
Exactly. This really must signal the upturn narratively here, right? Because we go from this fantastic disco track into the aforementioned Razzmatazz, which can only be a banger with a name like that.
Her makeup is faded and her fame is dated. She says her place ain't very far. Razzmatazz, all night jazz.
That was Razzmatazz, John Travolta, Travolta Fever. This song, when I was listening to this, my prevailing thought was, this is our parents' version of the Whitlams' I Make Hamburgers. Except I believe the events all actually happened. I think this song is 100% true and real, and it's just a list of John Travolta's sexual conquests while he was making his name on Welcome Back, Kotter.
Yeah, I think so. It's funny that as you say that, like, you know, the reference to our parents and what they're listening to there, a lot of this album I had, I'm sure, you know, a fairly patronizing response going, oh, it's so sweet. It's so innocent. It's so nostalgic. And then just out of interest, I looked up what else was released this year, right? Because I'm like, maybe all music in 1978 was innocent and sweet. And it's not so. It was a great year for music. So many people released incredible albums. You had Lou Reed and Blondie and Kate Bush and Van Halen and Judas Priest and, oh, Macho Man by the Village People was released that year. That's more in line with Razzmatazz. But it what a time for music. You were really getting a buffet off, weren't you?
Well, it's interesting as well because we think of this as, and maybe it's the compilation element of it, but we think of this as a 70s album. It's an incredibly 70s album, and it feels like the early 70s, but this is 78. Like, you two are showing up in 2 years. Like, this is not early on in the set. Like, everyone else is transitioning out, and this is like a throwback. And even Razzmatazz, like, firstly, it doesn't live up to its name whatsoever. There's very little Razzmatazz going on
here. Very
little. But, like, it's like the Hollywood, like, it feels like a gender-flipped Mary Tyler Moore theme. Like, it's like, you know, here's what living in the big city is like, and oh my God, it's so exciting and wild. And you're like, we're kind of over this now.
Yeah, it's not a vibe, y'all. It's not. I would also like to say congratulations, James, because this is what episode number what, six? And six from six U2 references from you, so well done.
Yeah, not, absolutely.
Not a record goes by where you don't mention U2, which is fair enough.
Yeah. Eventually we'll transition this into our actual podcast where I go through every album of U2 telling you track by track why they're perfect.
Now, are you still feeling the Travolta fever at this point? Be honest with me. Can you push on?
Look, A Girl Like You bought us some time. Rainbows, I was ready. Oof. Like, I had gone from two songs in being like, this is one of the greatest albums we've ever done, to, oh, I would like to end my life now. And then I was back in. And then Razzmatazz, the only thing I will say is it's good gossip. Like, that's what I got from this song. So I was still in. Mm. And then I'm like, oh, we're getting to the nitty-gritty of what John Travolta was up to. And I don't think anyone would have had a more interesting mid-70s than John Travolta.
I would agree with that. Okay, so we're both still in, but just by a thread. The next song is called...
My favorite title.
My favorite title too, because it's something that a fuckboy would say to you at a bar. It's called, I Don't Know What I Like About You, Baby.
Something I say to my daughter every day.
I don't know.
That is, I Don't Know What I Like About You, Baby, John Travolta, Travolta Fever, a song that sounds like it's sung over the top of the orchestral tune they play before the news on, like, the ABC.
Who knew that the ABC the Sting was a remix of Travolta Fever? That song, I mean, it's truly beautiful. It features lyrics of such a romantic nature, including, I don't know what I like about you, baby. I don't know why I love to love you, baby. I don't know what I like about you, baby. Maybe it's you. Maybe. I'm not questioning what's going on. It's just, oh, James, it's every little girl's dream to be talked to in this way.
Maybe you should work out what you like about her and then write a song about that. That'd be quite good.
I think that's really good advice for all budding songwriters out there. There's no denying that the thesis statement of the song could use a little bit of clarity.
This feels like, what if ELO was boring? Like, it's really interesting, like, the orchestral nature of all the backing of this. And then just, like, I can imagine the scenario here, which is he's booked the orchestra, he's got all the sheet music together, they've done, this is a massive operation, they're all mic'd up, everyone is in, and he gets up to the mic and he's like, oh God, I have nothing to say. I have nothing at all to say. Oh, do you know what? Just roll it, I'll come up with something.
And he doesn't. He still doesn't know what he likes about you, baby, no matter how many times he sings that line.
Which is ironic considering the next song is titled, Baby, I Could Be So Good at Loving You. Baby, I Could Be So Good at Loving You. Baby, I Could Be So Good at Loving You.
Baby, I could be so good at loving you.
Baby, I Could Be So Good at Loving You from Travolta Fever. Song that... straight nothing. Can we move on?
Let's move on straight away, because the next song I actually have quite a fondness for. The next song is called Big Trouble. Let's listen.
It's cold in the morning and I still can't sleep. And I'm in a big trouble. Big, 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 big trouble.
That was Big Trouble, which also describes the current state I'm in because the Travolta fever has once again flared up. I really enjoyed that song. It feels to me quite childlike, lyrically as well. I was king of the neighborhood until you moved in. There's a bit of a turf war going on. But it feels like the theme to something like Dennis the Menace or one of those sort of Saturday, like, weekend kids shows. Don't you reckon?
I think you're right on. This is something that I really enjoyed as well. And I would be embarrassed to, like, it would turn up in a playlist of mine. Like, because it feels like this sweet spot between the Grateful Dead and Buddy Holly. Like, aren't Venn diagrams you expect to overlap, but it just really feels like that. It's fun in a way I expected every bit of the album to be fun. Like, if the album was A Girl Like You, Big Trouble. And then, you know, let's say track 4 or 5, you go to Let Her In, Never Gonna Fall in Love Again. Not a bad album. And I would say, you know, if I was, say, combining a bunch of albums into a compilation, I would say maybe we take the fun ones and put them in and not necessarily put every song in this compilation.
Yes, because I will point out to our listeners that we still have 12 tracks to go. It's a marathon, not a sprint. It is really interesting as well, just in terms of the rhythm of the entire album, we've gone finally into this little more disco upbeat kind of section of songs here, and now we're going to firmly stick around what I would call lullaby territory for the next few songs. It's quite jarring, the sort of genre changes in this compilation.
So what we should also know is this is a record as well. So like after, so just so you know what your listening experience is, after Razzmatazz, you are picking up the record, you are turning it over, you're putting it on, and you get I Don't Know What I Like About You, Baby, and you really regret having turned it over. Big Trouble comes in at track 3 on your second side of your first vinyl here. And then we go to a song that I'm not even going to play for this because it is so interminable. He takes It Had to Be You, one of the most boring songs ever recorded, and says, can we take the energy out of this?
It's so funny to me too because we haven't had a cover yet, I don't think. I don't think we have. Anyway, It Had to Be You, which, you know, Billie Holiday sang and Frank Sinatra sang and everybody sang and no one remembers it because it's boring no matter which vocalist sings it. It's pretty enough, but we're just going to skip right along.
Yeah, let's go on to the high energy, high octane, ending the first of this two record set masterpiece. Good Night, Mr. Moon.
Good night, Mr. Moon. Lay down your sleepy head.
That was Good Night, Mr. Moon by John Travolta, a song that I must remind you was recorded with the specter of the Vietnam War in the background.
Good night, Mr. Moon.
Good night, Mr. Moon. Like this, like the credit where it's due here, this is the kind of like just Miller Lite 70s love song, like the little pining sad boy song. This was Drake to them. This is what it sounded like. Like it's fairly straight up and down. I don't think it's obnoxiously bad. It's just you wouldn't do this now. You just would have someone in the booth to be like, thanks, man, that sucks. Can we just bin that?
Also, Mr. Moon is trying to sleep. Stop saying goodnight for so long. Let Mr. Moon go. Let him drift off.
All right, Bridie, I have to ask you now. We're at the end of the first vinyl record. Are you putting on the second of this two record set?
I mean, if you hadn't accidentally made me listen to these 20 songs, I would say, yeah, let's call it. But because you've made me go through it all, I feel like it's only fair that we push on for a bit. Also, my favorite lyric on the entire record is up next in the song Slow Dancing, so we have to listen to it, please.
This love is beautiful, like hand in glove. We're so suitable.
That was Slow Dancing, John Travolta, Travolta Fever. Bridie, if you would.
I would wager that there is no song ever recorded that would be more uncomfortable to actually slow dance to than this song, Slow Dancing, with lyrics such as, feels so nice, just enough spice, feels divine, that's a good sign. And it's too slow. There's slow dancing and there's like dirgy slow dancing. It's too slow, James. This is not romantic or sexy dancing.
I feel like it's really built for like the teacher at the disco or whatever the hell they are is trying to find something that is that can be the last song of the night but isn't actually spicy. Like you don't want to hype up the kids too much, but you have to have one song at the end of the disco. And it feels like Travolta's playing to this as well. Like just call it Slow Dancing. Someone looking for a slow dance song will put it on. We'll get the plays. It'll work that way. It's nothing. It's how do you open the second record to this?
James, I think we're alone in our opinion, though, because this is one of the other singles that charted from this record. This was quite a popular track. So I don't know if it's that, you know, we're just wrong or times have changed so much, but enough people loved this song and presumably slow danced to it that it's really making me question my entire taste in music.
At least one person listening to this podcast was conceived to this song.
Oh, yuck. That's not right. This is the least sexy song ever. No, thank you.
Let's move on to the next track.
Must we?
You set my dreams to music.
You set my dreams to music as you spend the whole night making them come true.
That was You Set My Dreams to Music, John Travolta, Travolta Fever. Bridie, so we have a baby monitor that plays little tunes and things to try and relax Bub when she's going to sleep. Mm-hmm. And it feels like every backing track of the last four songs could be one of the little melodies that plays out of the baby monitor. Every one of these is this just it was the 70s and there wasn't much to do? Like, it's fine to have songs that just go on and on. It's a quantity over quality issue. What's going on here?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the baby monitor, because this is yet another track which makes me think of John Travolta. You know, just I just quickly looked up. He was 24 when this album came out, so pretty young, but it feels way more boyish than that. You know, it feels quite childlike. Yeah. A lot of the lyrics, a lot of the arrangements, the vocal performance is really sweet, but I wouldn't say it's like got any of that more macho flavor that we've seen him conjure in, you know, on screen. This is very boyish, which is not a bad thing, but it's just so sort of gentle, but then it'll divert into this like full-on quite big territory for some of the songs that I'm finding it quite a jarring experience. I'm not getting a picture of him as a singer here.
That's interesting as well. Like, we're also not getting like a lot of the tracks like this will have an emotionality to them. Like, if even if the song is bad, you can tell that the singer is trying to say something about themselves. I don't get a lot of that from these albums. Like, the only one where I felt like I was getting real insight to the mind of John Travolta was Razzmatazz. that's the only time it feels like he has been honest in this album. Everything else is just trying to appeal to a certain section of the you know, Travolta stands.
It's interesting too, because, you know, reading a few of the profile pieces on him from around this time, that, you know, I mentioned it before, a Rolling Stone profile on him from this year. There's also a piece in the LA Times from about a decade later. In a lot of the profile pieces that I've read of him in the 70s and 80s, he is a bit cagey. He is really considered before he answers questions, like the journalists note that he's really carefully trying to think of what to say. So perhaps he is quite conscious of what he's putting out there and the way his fans are going to interpret what he does. He mentions a few times in one of the articles that he's really scared of saying the wrong thing, but maybe it's to me kind of got that sense of when you're so scared to say the wrong thing and offending someone that you just stick to this really sweet territory.
It feels like in the same It Had to Be You sense, it's almost like the, you know, Great American Songbook, here are some just inoffensive ballads for you. Like, these are things that no one will have any problems with. I'm not going to get censored for. And also, like, it's not as sexy as I was expecting. Like, it's not as high octane, we're the young, fun generation and we're going for it. This is a lot more, you're sitting alone listening in those giant 70s headphones in your room and looking out the window at the moon that you have said goodnight to like 9 times.
Yeah, I feel like it's inoffensive and sweet, but doesn't particularly leave me with, like, a distinct taste in my mouth.
Yeah, it's music for dumb babies. I agree. Bridie, I'm out.
Oh, thank God. Thank God you're out. I'm out too. In fact, of the remaining 8 tracks, I only took notes for one of them, which is like, yay, back to disco. But I just... I don't think I can do it anymore. I love John Travolta, but I can't listen to this anymore.
Yeah. It's a real war of attrition. This is why the way Travolta's career works is he dazzles you for a bit, disappears for a while, just long enough so when he turns up again, you're like, oh shit, it's John Travolta, cool. Like, this is what this album needs. There needed to be about an 8-year gap between records and then come out with the second half and be like, oh, wow, John Travolta's here again.
I think so. I think it just needed a bit of time and space. Just because you're on top of the world doesn't mean you need to release an album. I think it's a valuable lesson for all of us and one that I'll certainly be taking on board personally.
So, Bridie Connell, was this album a mistake?
I mean, let's go back to what you mentioned at the start. In his Wikipedia entry, it says 1970s, stardom. Then this album comes out. And then the 80s, we have a downturn. It certainly didn't seem to do him a lot of favors in the short term. It's worth saying that he did have a few singles from this compilation album that charted again. He was awarded the Billboard's award for the new pop male vocalist of the year around this time. It had its fans. It had enough praise, but I don't think this did him any favors. What do you think, James?
I agree. I think it's low energy. I feel like that this one is a mistake because it seems so easy to bat 100 on it. You've got like every time there's been a disco tune in this, we've been right into it. It's been great. It's been high energy. It's been fun. Every time he has had fun with it, it's been good. And that doesn't happen enough. Like, how do you keep Olivia Newton-John off this album? Like, how do you do all... If we have to be subjected to them doing duets at Carols in the Domain for a fucking 15 years straight, surely you can, like, get her... Like, it feels like there's... It's riding too much on the wave of Travolta. And when you examine it outside of that wave... It's, do you know what it's like? It's like when you listen to Octopus's Garden outside of the context where everything the Beatles do has to be genius.
Uh-huh.
Like, what the wet fuck is this? And why is it on anything? Like, this is what it feels like to me. You had the juice and you tried to take a heat check, and sometimes heat checks don't work out. I don't think this heat check worked out.
I don't think it worked out either. I did come across an interesting couple of quotes which sort of frame or sort of look at this album being released within the context of like the disco era having this huge moment, and then it's the end of the 70s, this album comes out, and then we shift our attention to other things culturally. And I thought this was interesting. The director of Look Who's Talking, Amy Heckling, said, I have this theory that people are embarrassed about anything that they liked in the 70s. I think people hold their hatred for discos against John Travolta and for bell bottoms and the rest of the fads. And kind of goes on to say that by the end of the 70s, the disco wave had kind of passed. People thought things were a bit naff. And because they associated John Travolta so strongly with the disco era, he, by extension, was naff, and therefore it was not acceptable to like him. So they just had to like other actors for a little while, and then he did have that big resurgence. I don't know if it's entirely fair, but I do think we do have those biases.
I think that's accurate, and I also think one thing that has stood the cultural test of time is Look Who's Talking 3, where the dogs start talking. Great film. Great movie.
I'm so glad you really engaged with the researched arguments that I put forward there. You really took away the academic material. Thank you so much.
I think Bruce Willis plays, is he the baby or the dog? Anyway, the dog's named Rox. He's named Rox, and because he thinks the kid smells like cookies and dirt. Great film. Highly recommend you check it out.
Well, that's been another episode of Vanity Project. We've lived.
The dog fights off a whole bunch of wolves at one point. It's like really dramatic because you're like, is he going to even survive?
James, you're John breaking Travolta up. We can't hear you. You're on mute. Reconnect. Rejoin the stream.
Hello?
Listeners.
Hello.
I'm so sorry. That brings us to the end of another episode of Vanity Project. And look, it may not have been our favorite album, but we sure did have some great moments of razzmatazz, for which we will always be grateful.
We'll always believe in razzmatazz. Thank you all for checking out the show, particularly those of you who have written us reviews. I hate to be that person on a podcast saying reviews really help, but there's a reason everyone on every podcast says that. You can find us on Instagram at Vanity Project Pod, and send this episode to a friend or an enemy. Fuck it, we don't care. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week.
Bye.